Community development is also one of my major concerns, of course, in the academy and also in ISKCON. So I've chosen to take this text, text 9 of chapter 22, canto 3 of the Srimad Bhagavatam, so that we can proceed from there. So, again, I'm happy to be here. And I think that I did give my word that I'll be coming, I'll try as much as possible to come perhaps every year. So I came into the country on the 15th of April. I was in India, and then I went to Africa. I stayed a very long time in Africa. And then I went back to India, then came back to Africa, and then came to New York on the 15th of April. I came on the 15th because there were some scholars, some students at Columbia University that were pushing for me to come to deliver a talk there. So I had a presentation there at Columbia University on the 17th, just 2 days when I arrived, on religion and social justice, the role of religion in promoting social justice. Also, of course, social justice is something very much advocated in the Vedic literature, because basically we are saying we are not these bodies. Whether you are a small body, a female body, a male body, the spiritual identity is the same thing. But all those things are there in our literatures. It's just that, you know, the terminologies are different. They use different terminologies for political purposes, for political motives, or whatever. But all these so-called stuffs that people are simply masquerading as champions of different causes, they are all there in our Vedic literature. So I made a presentation, and they very much loved it. I think the chief editor of the journal that invited me for the talk, she wants to do a program, a research work on Krishna next semester. So there are a lot of opportunities we have. It's a matter of reaching out to the people in different disguises, because some people can't really go straight to tell them Krishna's true Bhagavan Swayam. But if we have other means of reaching out any person, why not? We have to do that. So let's go to this text. Without having to waste so much of your time, I was very much enlivened when I came in during the last lap of the Guru Puja, and, you know, temple hall was full with many devotees gyrating. That's the beauty of Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada had mentioned repeatedly, chant and be happy. So if we're chanting, why not? We'll be happy. So this chapter basically deals with the marriage of Kardama Muni and Devahuti. Praya vrato tanapadha. Praya vrato tanapadha. Swaseyam duhita mama. Avinchati patim yuktam. Vayashila gunadibi. Prayavrato tanapado. Swaseyam duhita mama. Amvichati patim yukta. Vayashila gunadibi. Can someone try?
Thank you.
languages. Prihavrata Uttanapada. Of Prihavrata and Uttanapada. Svasa. Sister. Iyam. This. Duhita. Dora. Mama. Mine. Amvichati. Is seeking. Patim. Husband, Yuktam, suited, Vaya Shila Guna Adibi, by age, character, good qualities, etc. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace is confirmed Acharya, Shila Bhashan, Vinda Bhaktivedanta Swami, Prabhupada Maharaj Ki, Shila Prabhupada Ki. And Dora is the sister of Prihavrata and Uttanapada. She is seeking a suitable husband in terms of age, character, and good qualities. Please respond to repeat. My daughter is the sister of Prihavrata.
My daughter is the sister of Prihavrata.
And Uttanapada. She is seeking a suitable husband.
She is seeking a suitable husband.
In terms of age, character, and good qualities. Purport. The grown-up daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, Devahuti, had good character and was well qualified. Therefore, she was searching for a suitable husband just befitting her age, qualities, and character. The purpose of Manu's introducing his daughter as the sister of Prihavrata and Uttanapada, two great kings, was to convince the sage that the girl came from a great family. She was his daughter, and at the same time, sister of Kshatriyas. She did not come from a lower class family. Manu therefore offered her to Kadama as just suitable for his purpose. It is clear that although the daughter was mature in aging qualities, she did not go out and find her husband independently. She expressed her desire for a suitable husband corresponding to her character, age, and quality. And the father himself, out of affection for his daughter, took charge of finding such a husband. Om Ajnanati Mirandasya Jnananjana Salakaya Saksulun militam jena tasma si gorave namaha si chaitanya mano bhistam sakritam jena bhutale sayam rupam kadamayam dadati swapadantikam. So, this basically is a preamble or the beginning of the arrangement of the marriage of Devahuti to Kadama. And keep in mind that the person who is making this effort to get the child married to a suitable husband was no other person than Swayambhuva Manu, emperor of the universe. So, we find that in the Vedic literature, in most cases, we don't find common people who are used as an example. We find very important personalities, significant others, kings, or warriors, renowned warriors, very rich people. So that people don't take undue advantage, or what is there to say? Well, because I'm so big, I'm so great, so I have transcended, you know, these are minor things. I don't have time for it. This is a community, for instance. And a community is simply the larger dimension of the family. And for the community to have people of developed characters, it means that our families have to produce children of developed characters. And for our families to produce children of developed characters, there has got to be proper matrimonial matches. That's essentially what Swayambhuva Manu is out here to do. Although he was such an exalted emperor, he did not neglect his social obligations to his kids, to his daughter, in this case, Devahuti. Believe it or not, when a girl gets to a marriageable age, the major anxiety is, who is the husband I'm going to get married to? I remember there was a girl who was doing a PhD in Nigeria, and her major worry, and she will openly confess. She will say, I'm doing this PhD, but where is the husband? I'm not going to marry my PhD. Where is the husband? So we can circumvent this social structure in society. So the Vedic society or Vedic culture was also very much designed in such a way that parents become responsible not only in training their children, but also in trying to see that their children get suitable spouse or suitable spouses. So in the Prabhupada mentioned that it is not very much aligned with Vedic civilization for a child to go out his way to seek out a spouse. Why? Because the child may not be very much conversant with the requisite characteristics feature of a spouse. And the child may just be enamored to the external features of the opposite sex. Therefore, the parents have to guide the child to be able to create an enabling environment for the child's future as far as the sociology of marriage is concerned. So here Swayambhuva Manu is giving us a very practical example that we should not leave our children into the street to seek out suitable spouse for themselves. At best, what the children do is they will be governed by or they'll be impelled by endogenous and exogenous forces completely beyond their jurisdiction, outside of their jurisdiction, to choose what will not even be suitable for their own family development. That is why Swayambhuva Manu took it upon himself to go to Kadama Muni's ashram, to his own hermitage, to make the proposal to Kadama Muni. And so we'll find out. Of course, at that time, Kadama Muni also was contemplating on having a spouse. And Swayambhuva Manu went there to meet him to make this proposal, and it worked. And we'll find out Devahuti was such an exalted girl. Not only exalted in terms of character development, but she was also superlatively beautiful. I remember there was an instance where she was playing at the top of the father's building, and one personality, he was riding an airplane, and he was enamored by Devahuti's beauty, and he fell off. So, Devahuti was not a common girl, a common woman. She was externally beautiful. And as far as Swayambhuva Manu was concerned, he felt it was his obligation to see that his girl got an appropriate husband, a suitable husband. And therefore, we have to understand that for our communities to grow in Krishna consciousness, we have to have Krishna-centered families. And for us to have Krishna-centered families, it means that husband and wife have to be Krishna conscious. They must have some developed character. And even Swayambhuva Manu, he mentions here that the suitable husband has to be in terms of age, character, and good qualities. Age, character, and good qualities. Age in the sense that the wife or the girl shouldn't go to marry, maybe the girl is 20 and she goes to marry someone who is 60 years old. It doesn't work in that way. Or the girl has a PhD and she marries someone who didn't even finish high school. It doesn't work in that way. The marriage won't last. And so all of these basic things have to be put together properly. Therefore, we find that this is still very predominant in India. If the children finish their careers, the parents take it as their responsibility to be able to figure out for a suitable spouse for the child. And that is one reason why the marriages in India endure more than any country you can think of in the world. Because they stick strictly following the Vedic, the Vedic standard as far as marriage is concerned. And for us to be able to sustain a society or a Krishna conscious community, it means that our children have to be of a good character oriented. Because if the children have a proper attitude to service in terms of, for instance, their sadhana, like Prahlad mentioned, Kumar, Achar, Pragyo, the Krishna consciousness has to begin right from a tender age. And here in the purport, Swayambhuva Manu had mentioned that Devahuti is a sister to Prayavrata and Uttanapada. Uttanapada is the father of Dhruva Maharaj. And we all know the story of Prince Dhruva, how he was sitting on his father's lap and his stepmother came to chastise him, drag him out of the place, insulted him. He sought for help from his mother. The mother couldn't do anything. Rather, the mother was crying. However, the mother told him that if he wanted a kingdom greater than that of his dad, he should seek out those blessings from Lord Vishnu. And Dhruva got those primary instructions from his mother. So again, we see that if the mother, although the mother looks like someone who was very helpless during the conflict, but at least the mother gave instructions that led to Dhruva's liberation, that led to Dhruva achieving his goals. So again, we find that if the family is properly situated in God consciousness, it doesn't mean that there are not going to be challenges, there are not going to be difficulties, like we find in the case of Dhruva and Uttanapada, his father. It's not that there are not going to be difficulties in the family. There could be difficulties in the family, but husband and wife must have to see that they work out things in an amicable way without even a third party hearing about it. In Africa, they have an adage which says that if it is husband and wife that are making some quarrel, don't go in the middle. Because they may have some, you know, some misunderstanding now, and the next moment you see them laughing and smiling and dining. So if you go into the middle and say you want to, you know, then you run up becoming an enemy of the family. Essentially, family life should be based on amicable understanding. It's not that people are not going to have some difficulties, but the idea is that, like we have this family setting, who is that child? Who is going to feel happy seeing the father and the mother nagging each other or quarreling? No child is going to be happy. And therefore, if I say, I love my child, and I mess up his mother right before the child, that's not going to give us myself and the child a very enticing and sustainable relationship. Because children, as a matter of fact, they even love their mother more than their father in most cases. And so it's important for us to see how we are developing our communities based on using the family as a nucleus. In other words, we should be very more concerned for our children, just like Swayambhuva Manu. Swayambhuva Manu was such a caring thinker that after training the child properly, he made the arrangement for the child to get a proper spouse. Because the future of the child depends on what type of spouse he or she has. If you have a spouse who's going to just give you nags all through the day, you're not going to be happy. Therefore, the parents had an obligation in those days to see to it that they don't let their child go into the street by themselves to look for a spouse. Of course, in different cultures, it's different. But if we are adhering, if we are aligning with the Vedic culture, we should see what we can derive from these type of episodes or these stories. What we can get from that. Because we have experimented with so many things in the past. And so many things fell apart. So many marriages fell apart. And therefore, it is important for significant others to participate, for parents and guardians to participate in the arrangement of marriages for their children or for their wives. Because we shouldn't take it lightly. It is a lifetime project. Most projects we engage in or we get ourselves involved is very temporary. They are very temporary projects. It's like if I'm in Florida, I have some job here. That's my project. But I can relocate to California and I change my job. This project is a lifetime. Marriage is a lifetime. Taking care of your children is also a lifetime, because no matter how old the child is, the parent will still say, "Hey, my boy, come here." I remember something when I was a Brahma child. I was in New Jersey. You know, I was speaking with my mom on the phone, and then you know she asked me, "So when are you coming?" I felt very infuriated. I was just thinking, I'm an old man. And she's just thinking like, this was my thought. Is she thinking of my husband? Why is she asking me, when am I coming? But the point is, no, parents have that feeling, no matter whether you're old, so far your parents are still, they're still alive, they still see you as their child. And so they give orders. Hey, come here. That is the beauty of family relationship. But it involves some cost. Some curse is there because if we want good things, we have to work hard towards those good things. If a child wants a bright future, the child has to go to school. The child has to develop skills. Therefore, if we want a good family setting, we want our communities, our Krishna consciousness communities, to grow in leaps and bounds. We have to have good ground. We have to be grounded in formidable marriages. And that has to be piloted. We should not only send our children to school, we should care for them until they get suitable spouses. That is the import. Or that is what we can go home to chew with from this very text. Each time you find a text in the Bhagavatam with purport, the direct statements could be compared to the breadth of knowledge. The purpose of the acharyas we could say the purports are the depth of knowledge. But then the integration of the purports, for instance, of Srila Prabhupada, and the original statements of Swayambhuva Manu, if we integrate that and apply that in our own life, that amounts to application of information culture, transcendental information culture. What people lack in most cases is the application. And therefore, we understand what Swayambhuva has done here. The question is, what does this imply to us? We understand Swayambhuva's concerns. We understand his caring thinking. But what does that imply to us? So there are so many things that we can actually derive from here. There are so many things we can learn to be able to help in the development of our society, of our organization, and of our own immediate community here. And of course, our families. We have children, and we have to care for our children. We have spouses, and we have to care for our spouses. Otherwise, there's no question of pleasing the acharya. There's no question of pleasing Lord Krishna. Because everybody we find in our family is part and parcel of Lord Krishna. Therefore, we have to care for each and every one in our family, just like Swayambhuva Manu. Are there some comments or some questions on this point? Yes. Yes. Oh, Sisha, why are you hiding there? You went right at the back of that. Yes.
Is that the correct understanding?
Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada is mentioning that, you know, one could interpret this verse to mean that, you know, this is just for the women, for the girls. But Swayambhuva is basically concerned here about devahuti, but just like in a Vedic culture, the child, even the male child, we have to have a concern for the male child. I remember one girl wrote me a mail. She's in the university. She wrote me a mail that about, you know, the boy that she was trying to get married. And then she said, but you know, the problem here, Maharaj, is that, you know, his parents are against it. His parents don't want me to marry him. So, but he said, oh, the boy is very good and all these things. So I said, well, It is a good idea that you have such an affection for this boy, and she has an affection, I mean, and he also has an affection for you. You people want to get married. But marriage means that you are not only marrying this boy, you are also marrying the whole family. So if the father and then the mother say they don't want you, so where is he going to marry you to? On the street? You're going to marry to the family. So I said, you better reason it out, because marriage is not just you and the boy alone. It's the girl and the boy and both families. So I told her, you better reason it out, see what is most expedient for you to be able to do to salvage your situation. So even the boy, the parents play a very significant role in determining who the boy is going to get married to. And so, like we have in the Vedic culture, even it's still predominant in India, that the boy gets a marriageable age, the parents arrange. They consult with the girl's parents, and they work out the compatibilities in terms of astrological bearings and all of these other stuff, family backgrounds and all this, like what Swayambhuva Man has mentioned here, character development, the age and all these things. Then the both families, you know, resolve, yes, these kids will make a good match, will make a good family, they'll be able to help themselves. So, back to Sesha Prabhu's inquiry, it also applies to the boy. Even the boy, for instance, if a boy has been approached by the parents of a girl or by a girl, for the boy to accept Woli, he has to consult with his parents, discuss with them. And because the parents are the ones who have to give the support, the emotional support, the economic support, etc. I know in some cases, parents, they have to work so hard to develop economically so that, you know, they build a house for their child, so that they have a big balance for their child for schooling, and when they finish school, they have to buy the child a car. During marriage, they have to do this and do that. So, in both cases, be a girl or a boy, parents have to be involved, because marriage does not simply mean that, you know, we are taking someone into the street or we're just boxing someone in one apartment and that's it. Because, you know, there's a joy. I mean, I was in New York and then in one devotee's home, so himself and his wife, you know, they said we should go and visit their first son. And, you know, they had a lot of joy when the boy came down with his wife. You know, they were kissing each other, the child and then the parents. So the girl or the wife of the boy also came and was very much in warm embrace with the boy's mother, the mother-in-law. So in both cases, you know, parents have to be involved. Significant others have to be involved. And it makes a lot of meaning, and it brings a lot of collective joy when these things are there. However, we may say that the cultures are different, which is true. But we have to see which is most pragmatic, to be able to evolve a culture or a family setting that is going to be sustainable. So yes, even the boy have to seek the consent of his parents before getting married. Thank you very much. Yes, Prabhu?
I was wondering if you could contrast the difference between the considerations in the Karmakanda view of marriage and the Bhakti view of marriage in a spiritual society that's aimed at...
Well, that's a nice point. You know, I witnessed like eight marriages some years back, I think in the late 80s, and it was still simply based on, you know, we are devotees. There's no need to follow any rules. Just get married. no need to make any matching or whether it's suitable or not suitable. You're chanting Hare Krishna, I'm chanting Hare Krishna. Let's just get married. Finish. I saw 9 marriages, it's only one that is still sustained. 9 of them had a wedding, all of them have broken off. Because we took for granted, we experimented. You know, there's nothing wrong in making a research. Like, you know, I mean, I was conducting some research at Walden University at Minneapolis a year ago on race and happiness. Does race have any positive or negative impact on happiness? So I found that, you know, race has no bearing with happiness. Whether you're white, black, brown, or whatever, it does not really have to, it has no bearing with your happiness. So the point is, if we discard the Vedic culture in total, in lieu of our devotional exhilaration or our devotional hype, or that we are devotees, we are Vaishnavas, and there is no need to follow, you know, Vedic customs or Vedic rituals and all these things. But normally when people make those type of assertions, I will always refer them to Nanda Maharaj inviting Garga Muni during when Krishna was born in Balaram. Garga Muni was the Kula Acharya of Nanda Maharaj, and Garga Muni was invited to come and figure out, what are these children up to? So, the point is, we can follow all of the ritualistic ceremonies in the Vedic literature as far as we are practicing Krishna consciousness, but there are essential issues that we cannot sweep it under the carpet. Take, for instance, marriage issues. Marriage issues, there should be a way to figure out. Look at what Swayambhuva Manu mentions here. There should be some proper matching based on character, based on age, based on good qualities. And therefore, if we want to sustain our families, if we want to sustain our society, our communities in a Krishna conscious, oriented ways, we have to see how we are tapping. You know, in material life, they said, you can cross the borders, but just make sure you don't pick everything that you find on the other side of the country. Pick only the good things. So yes, we're trying to be devotees, and every one of us is not going to be a sannyasi or a sannyasini. Majority of our devotees are going to get married. Therefore, I mean, and I used to advocate Randa Maharaj's principle in Chopati and, you know, Pune, that even the devotees who have to be, whom we have to train as full-time priests, we should see how they are, I mean, what is their background. If they have skills, then we don't risk anything in terms of in the future when they decide, I'm going to get married. So it is essential that we look at things positively. There's nothing wrong in devotee simply discarding the Vedic rituals. But there are some essential features of the Vedic tradition that if we are professing to be devotees, we cannot really get to the background. And typically, a typical example is in the case of marriage, that we have to see how parents are becoming involved. Parents' consent are being sought because the parents give the blessings to the marriage. And we have to also find out ways of seeing how suitable the matches, the compatibilities of the proposed spouses. It makes a lot of sense. And if we neglect that, we still continue have to run on the line of experiments that in most cases will get defeated at the long run. Experiments have been performed already, and the Vedic literatures have given us a sense of direction. And so we should do the needful to be able to sustain our families and to sustain our Krishna conscious societies. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
The laws of Manu says a girl 12 years marries a boy of between 20 and 30 years. That does not seem to apply at this day and age because no one would accept that. But in terms of age, I mean, Srila Prabhupada does not explain it in any way, but But what's the recommended age for marriage for a girl and a boy? I mean, we have to have some, you know, some way to measure and to assess that. It's, I mean, in modern society, a girl and boy, they would go around for a long time, and then they probably get married in their 40s or 30s or 40s. We cannot accept that.
Okay.
But within our society, we have to have an acceptable age, you know, I mean, for the girl and for the boy. Do you have any idea or suggestion or any research into it?
That question is supposed to be answered by the GBC. Sasha is here. So. But I can give you some rudiment in terms of, because see, we also have to take, I appreciate your point that, you know, you mentioned something that, you know, that is not applicable. You see, it's just like we have even theories in the social sciences. There are premises in the different fields of knowledge. There are constructs and concepts. And there are also ideologies, what to do and what not to do. But in most cases, we'll find that, for instance, the laws in the Manu Samhita, we can't apply all the laws in the Manu Samhita to present the society. So yes, I share that zeal. And the point that, you know, how do we determine, oh, what age is a girl suitable for marriage? Yes, that's a good point. The thing is that we have to take cognizance of the social structure in society nowadays. Now, the age in this 21st century, there is so much of economic depletion, economic meltdown. Nowadays, see, originally in the very age, women don't go to work. Their work is home maintenance. They manage the home. But nowadays we find that because of economic depletion, women are also asked to work. I remember, you know, one devotee was, someone was trying to get married to one girl. The girl is a doctor. And, you know, the boy was telling me that I wanted to get married to her, but she said that she won't work. Okay. She's a medical doctor, okay? She said that when she gets married, she won't work. So because of that, the boy shied away, you know? So, the practical thing is that people want economic boom in the family. And because that is a whole idea of working, is the whole idea of trying to generate a high economy or high economic status, then we have to take into the consideration, should a girl even go to school? Now, we may say in the Vedic culture, girls don't go to school. But this is Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga, even there is so much of divorce in Kali Yuga. So I tell you, if I have a girl today as a daughter, I must make sure that at least she gets a first degree before she gets married. At least a first degree. Why? Because that will save her the risk of being played like a football by some men. I give you a vivid example. I have a friend in New Jersey. The niece got married to a very wealthy guy. They are Indians. The niece got married to a very wealthy guy, and the niece did not go to school. And you know what is happening now? The niece is being abused heavily. She can't make a report. She has two kids, and Indian girls are very much afraid of divorce. So she has two kids. She's been heavily abused. The uncle, I told him, you salvage this girl. He said, what could he do? That the girl doesn't want to leave the man because she has two kids. Now the major concern is that she had no education. If she leaves the man, she would just be in the street. Now, the point is that if the girl is also having some sound education, especially in Kali Yuga, then we can say, for instance, some people they graduate when they're 21 or 22 or whatever. I mean, even see, if you are even in school and you want to get married, that's no problem. But then the point is that we have to understand that there's a need for our children to reflect properly the Vedic tradition, and we can't play around it. Because when the child gets to attains puberty, the blood or the system is infused with hormones that force the child to act even against their better judgment. And so it is essential for us to understand the child's development so as to tailor our efforts in terms of helping the child in that direction. So I would say I don't have any set down age, a specific age, because it all depends on when the child has got a suitable spouse. If you say, okay, at this age, the child must get married, or the girl must get married, what if she gets to that age and there is no husband? What will happen? Yes.
Interesting point. But the point of celibacy is very essential also, following religious principles. It's not that, you go to college, get a first degree, but you jump a few men and that's fine, or with a boy also, doing the same thing. He gets a degree, but he went around with about 10 women, That's within our process. That's not acceptable behavior.
Yes.
You see? And, so that is why the Vedic system actually emphasized that the girl actually get married younger, but... So I had a suggestion earlier. I suggested something whereby there's some form of an engagement, not necessarily a marriage, but at least to keep the girl peaceful and the boy peaceful, because to go to that long time, 21, 22, it's not so easy to be celibate. Especially in this day and age and what's going on out there, So. That's how I see it.
I think it's a good idea. I find one of the things that one of the things that I challenge people on Facebook is when they say I'm in a relationship. So I said, my question is, what type of relationship? Boyfriend and girlfriend? If it is boyfriend and girlfriend, the Vedic culture does not advocate that. So instead of me to say you're in a relationship, say you are engaged. If you're a devotee, say you're engaged. Otherwise, people will look at us as people who are also, haphazardly doing their things. So yes, I very much share your zeal again. I think we have a common ground here. But I have also seen a number of girls in our movement, 26 years old, and they are virgins. They went to college. I've also seen boys, 30 years old, they never met a man in our movement. It depends on the training, the type of samskaras the parents perform to invoke a particular child into the womb of the mother. Now, if a parent is simply, if it's just sexually agitated and it pounces on the spouse without any proper samskaras, definitely you're going to invoke a child that is not going to have high devotional qualities. So, yes, we understand the challenges in modern society, the environment is not very suitable. There is so much of all of these pornographies all over the place. Everything that I will agitate the mind, they are all over the place, the TV and all these things. But if we understand the implications of even watching a TV, violence that is replete with violence, or romantic affairs, then we have, this is one reason why we restrain ourselves from exposing our children to all of these unnecessary scenarios, because it has a lot of effect on the mind. And so if children are not properly guided, we may very much have good intention for them, but, they turn out to be people that we become disgusted with, but in most cases, we are the cause. If something goes wrong with our children, we should blame ourselves. We should guide our children properly. We should not just point a Christian finger, yo, you nonsense, you did this, you did that. Whose product? I mean, just like people, you know, condemn the politicians. Oh, they're fraudsters and they do this. But who gave birth to the politicians? We gave birth to them. They came from our families. So essentially, what is important for us is to be able to see how we are putting one and one together to help in creating a viable future for our society. And there are not so much of big rules about that. Individually, we should see what is best for myself and my family. What is best for my future, for the future of my kids. So Swayam Bhuva Manu set example for us here for us to be concerned about our children. My time is supposed to be up, but okay, last question. Okay, yes, mothers have not asked. Can someone, yes. I'm sorry. The men have been participating, but we shouldn't let them down, otherwise it becomes like, you know, we are marginalizing the women.
Thank you, Maharaj, for the class. My question is, for those of us who were not born into the movement, our parents are not devotees, uh-huh. Is there any importance to seeking their blessings in marriage?
Yes, that is important. I've seen situations where someone was going to be initiated and his Guru Maharaj asked him to go and invite his parents. I saw that recently in New Jersey. Bhakti Mark Swami was initiating was going to initiate some devotee, and you know the parents are not devotees, and the parents came. See, we have a mindset that I'm a devotee, my parents are not devotees. Damn you. Let me just renounce them. They are a bunch of nonsense. They're just a bunch of worry. No, we should not be so fast or so harsh with our parents. We should be tolerant. See, I tell you, for one thing, I knew my weaknesses in terms of family relationship. Therefore, when I moved into the temple for 16 years, I didn't have any communication even with my parents. 16 years. And then the first time I met them, you know, my father was like dancing, and he said, this was like a dream. Then I gave him Bhagavad Gita, I gave him all the Prabhupada's books, and then he was so happy. Imagine your child, you've not seen your child for 16 years, and he came and gave you some books, and he became so happy. Okay, so, but I don't personally cultivate them. But now I have some of my friends, some professor devotees who go to meet them. They hold even programs in their place, in their home. So we should not, you know, have this rash decision of simply denouncing our family just because we are devotees. I remember one of my friends in DC, and she mentioned to me that, you know, these parents are just a bunch of hogwash. Maharaj, is it not just good to just, you know, renounce them? Not to even go to them again, not to even communicate with them. I said, no. Just because you're a devotee and now you're just damning everyone, it's not worth it. We should be tolerant. We should be compassionate. To be a devotee is not so easy because we are doing it and we don't see how difficult it is for someone to even appreciate what devotional service is. So we should be patient. If we want to get married, yes, you have to let your parents know. Why not? Because you're going to family life. It means that your parents also should be aware of it. They should know. If you have a husband, even a husband devotee also will want to know who your parents are. They want to visit your parents. How are you going to cultivate them to be devotees? And so when you have a husband devotee, and then you go with your husband to your parents, you go with prasada, you're actually preaching to them. Just by them taking the prasada, they get purified. But if you simply renounce them, then you're not going to help matters much. So family life means, you know, marriage means family life. Family life means connection with, you know, parents also. All right? We don't advocate. I wouldn't advocate, you know, people getting married and then they don't seek consent of their parents, because that is not what is really most important for us. The most important thing is for us to be able to seek the blessings of our parents also. Blessings, it matters much. You may even work out the compatibilities of the person you want to marry because your parents are not there. But once that is concluded through your marriage counselors in the movement and all these things, still you need to let your parents know that you're getting married. Okay? It's so important for us. It also helps to build our public relations. All right, so I thought that we were going to close this class now. Yes.
I really appreciate everything you're saying. I agree with everything you're saying. And there's, like, I hear the ideal, and then we're dealing with the reality, what goes on. And I don't think any of us can say, well, we can force our kids to do what we want. You know, in today's society, it's just not going to happen. So I'm just, could you close the gap between the ideal and reality?
Yeah.
Give us some.
Yeah. The very principles are there. And like what is obtainable in modern day society is completely averse to the very tradition. And that's why we find that there's a collapse of the social system of marriage. And so, because we are aligning ourselves with the Vedic culture, at least our own children, we can't really force ourselves on them. But we should be able to motivate and inspire them in such a way that they align with the Vedic tradition so that they don't go astray and become victims of modern social culture. So the practical reality is that, yes, we tell them what is best for them and let them choose what they should do to be able to create a viable future for themselves. We can't just keep quiet and, you know, say, well, you know, this is the modern day system, so whatever you like to do. No, we should, from childhood, we should inspire our children to do the needful, for them to know what is best for them. And if they don't do it, they may regret it afterwards, but they will also realize and reflect on the point that my mom told me this. My dad told me this. I refuse to do it. That is it. If you do your duty, then your part is done. We can't force ourselves on people, you know. That's practical. All right. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.